Hi, everyone. We had a wonderful, thorough conversation with Jason Faulkner. So we decided to break this episode into two parts. Enjoy part one. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Soraya. How's it going?
All right. How about you?
I'm doing great, and I'm super excited for today. You know, this is one of my favorites.
Yes. So you want to let everyone know who we're talking with today?
Yes. Today we're talking to Jason Faulkner, who played with the 3 O'Clock. He played in Jellyfish. He played in the Grays. He's produced quite a few bands, Pugwash. He produced Daniel Johnston. He produced R. Stevie Moore. Tons of stuff. And then he's also collaborated with quite a few people. He plays guitar for Beck. He played with Paul McCartney on one of Paul McCartney's albums. But it's his solo stuff that I really like, so I can't wait to talk to him.
Such a varied resume. I'm really excited to hear a little bit more about him and his creative process. So why don't we start it?
Let's get started.
Awesome. Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme.
A podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, a groovear.
Let's get groovy. All right, so it's time to give Jason a call. Let's give him a call.
Sounds good.
Hello, Jason. This is Jeff and Soraya.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
We're doing great. So before we get started, we wanted to ask about this new organ purchase. What did you score?
Oh, it's an organ that I already have, but mine is it's kind of beyond repair. So it's an old 50s Hammond, but it's a little tiny. It's a very cool little organ. I've used it a lot. Since, going back to the Grays, because I think Jack Puig had one when we made the Grays record, and it's all over that record. It's all over pretty much everything I've done since then, except my last two records, because mine is not functioning. So I've been trying to replace it, because they get to a certain point where they are kind of unfixable. The tuning drifts within the keyboard itself, so it's not like globally flat or sharp. It's actually like just super cockeyed within itself, so like a C octave like will be almost a half step sharp or flat, like just, you know, holding two C's. It's just like a mess. So I've been looking to replace the one I have for about 5 years, and I finally found one, and it was like an hour and a half away, but the guy's gonna deliver it to me tomorrow. So the thing is, they're really cheap, so they're kind of not like a lot of guy, like Hammond guys won't even try and fix them, because they're like, dude, this is going to run you like $200 or $300, and you can get one of these for $150 when you can find one.
Nice.
So people don't even want to work on them, but they're kind of like one of my little secret weapon keyboards. So we don't really need to talk about it. but they're just really cool, and I hope that people don't catch on to them, because they do one thing, but they do it so cool. So.
Nice.
It's all of Beatles, The Bedtime with the Beatles, the first one as well.
Okay.
We definitely want to talk a little bit more about that release in a little bit. But for our listeners, I'm pretty sure that all of our listeners already know who our guest is today. But for those who don't, we're talking to Jason Faulkner, who began his musical career, recording career at least, with the 3 O'Clock playing guitar on their last album, Vermillion, not one of my favorites, then joining Fran... Roger Joseph Manning Jr. to form Jellyfish, who did a couple of amazing albums, but Jason was on their first album. And then, of course, the Grays, who released the album Rochambeau on Epic Records. And my favorite part, Jason, of your career is your solo material, so I'd like to focus on that the most. And you've done quite a few you've done quite a few guest spots and producing albums that have landed in my year-end top list for the last few years. And you're currently playing guitar with Beck. But we'll dig into some of those later. But we wanted to welcome you to Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme today.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here. And I agree with you about that Vermillion record. let's just go on record right away and say one of my favorite theaters.
Speaking of that, Jason, I want to let's just get out the gate, and I'll ask one. We want to ask just two quick questions about Vermillion before we move on to other stuff. Sure. So we wanted to know, how did you come to join the 3 o'clock for that last album, Vermillion, which was released on Princess Paisley Park label?
Yeah, there used to be a paper here in LA. It might still exist. I'm not sure, but it's called the Recycler.
Oh, yes.
It's like a classified paper. I think it was free. And I had just come back from, I worked in a cannery in Alaska when I was 17 and a half, like right out of school.
Wow.
My friends and I drove up to Alaska and I worked up there and kind of lose your mind up in Alaska, really, if you're working on a cannery. It's just like super subhuman conditions, and the whole experience was like Mad Max.
Wow.
You know, just crazy, like just end of days stuff up there. It's beautiful as well, but, you know, don't get me wrong, but the canneries themselves are fairly lawless. And so when I was up there, I really realized I need to get my act together and form a band and all this stuff and find other people to do this with, because there was nobody from my childhood that could really kind of keep up with what I wanted to do, and also just couldn't find people that shared the same kind of taste for certain things. So anyway, I came back and I put an ad out in this Recycler, and I got a copy of that week issue where my ad was to be, and was looking at it and making sure they spelled everything correctly and all that. And then I looked a little further, from musicians seeking bands to bands seeking musicians, which was the next little chapter in this paper. And I saw an ad from the 3 o'clock saying 3 o'clock looking for guitar player. And I'll never forget it. It said no metal, no country, and no flakes. So I called that, and turned out the phone number was Danny Bonaire, the drummer's home phone.
Oh, wow.
And so he and I just talked. That very first conversation I had with Danny was probably 2 hours long.
Wow.
It was insane. We just completely hit it off. And I was really into a lot of this kind of obscure British, what I called wimpy pop music. That's just what I lovingly refer to it as. But it was, you know, bands like the Pale Fountains and Care. What other bands? Farmer's Boys. There was this kind of scene of this kind of jangly, you know, Aztec Camera would have been kind of a spearhead band of that.
Oh, okay.
Orange Juice and all that stuff. And Danny was really into that as well. So we just had this kind of immediate bond with that music. And then, that's how I got in the band. I guess the legend has it. Hey, wow, there's a dog, little dog situation out here. wow.
We like special guests.
All gonna survive.
should we send in a search party or a rescue crew?
I think they're okay. They're just a little heated. But yeah, I.
So you hit it off with Danny right away?
I hit it with Danny right away, and then I auditioned, and according to their legend, I beat out over 100 guitar hopefuls.
Wow.
And found myself in that band.
Wow.
And, you know, the funny thing is, I mean, I was a huge fan of that band when I was in high school. Like, my high school band covered a couple of 3 o'clock songs. We did With a Cantaloupe Girlfriend and I Go Wild.
Wow.
And so I'd seen the 3 o'clock going back to maybe when I was 15 or 16 was the first time I saw them, out in the valley here in LA. So I was a big fan of that band, and had kind of, you know, moved on to other stuff by the time I had seen that, the listing in that paper. So I was like, wow, you know, 3 o'clock. And then all of a sudden I'm in the band and I'm like, wow, now I'm in the 3 o'clock. And then I hear the music that we were going to, it was going to comprise the next record. And I just kind of, it was a little bit of a disappointment for me, just because I loved them so much before.
Yeah. So,
and they had kind of gone, they kind of strayed from their, you know, their kind of Beatles, Via Monkeys, you know, 60s thing. They'd kind of strayed from that a little bit, and it sounded more modern in a bad way, in my opinion. So that was a little bit of a, like a wah-wah, you know, because here I am in this band that I loved, but the music wasn't what I loved about them, you know, so.
Right, you know. So we're huge fans of the 3 o'clock, and we've covered extensively Broke Ho Down, 16 Tambourines, and Arrive Without Traveling, but we haven't touched on Ever After or Vermillion, because, well, honestly, I don't care for those. The sound on the original stuff is so great, but I think what was happening in popular music, and especially with production at that time, really destroyed some great bands. And unfortunately, yeah, I think the 3 o'clock fell into that category. But their early stuff was amazing.
I would agree, yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that the weakest thing about both of those later records is the production. And especially the one I'm on. Production, in my opinion, and I was kind of kicking and screaming, you know, but I didn't really have a very loud voice in that band because I was the new kid and I was literally a teenager, and you know, and they were like, yeah, well, yeah, whatever, and I'm like, no, you guys, but we should all be playing, like, you guys are so good at live, you know, playing together, and like, what's the deal, like, everything was being separated, and a lot of the bass isn't even Michael playing, it's like a sampler, and you know, it's just like, It was a keeping up with the Joneses production thing, and the stuff that was happening, at least in the charts at that time, that were, you know, band kind of things, were this awful stuff, like, you know, Escape Club and right. You know, Information Society and things like that. It was just like, this band should not care about that, in my opinion. But again, nobody's really listening to me.
Yeah. So that kind of leads into what I originally had for my next question and last question about Vermillion. So it sounds like right off the bat, you weren't thrilled with where the band was going. And I imagine it's the same or worse now, looking back on it.
Well, I mean, now there's just kind of funny. I just did this Kinks thing with them. But that was the first time I had been on stage with Michael and Danny and Lewis was there. And that was the first, I mean, I'd never been on stage with Lewis, but you know, kind of quick little reunion, if you want to call it that. So, but yeah, I mean, making the record was, you know, I was so happy to just be making a record. I couldn't believe I was in a recording studio making an album, you know, with anybody. So I was just excited about that. And, yeah, the whole experience was, you know, not the most exciting. They were kind of at the end of their rope as well, as far as being a band, and you know, they'd already been around for quite a while with each other, so it just had a feeling of like, you know, last legs kind of thing,
right?
which is a drag to be around, especially when it's your first experience, you know,
right?
Yeah, from what we've talked to the guys,
that was challenging.
Yeah, from our recent conversations with the guys from the band, it sounds like they probably wished that they would have listened to the new kid that joined the band.
Oh, well, that's nice. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, they kind of felt the same way. I'm sure they felt the same way. I mean, nobody was happy to be replaced by an Akai sampler. I mean, I know Michael wasn't thrilled. And Danny, I remember Danny almost in tears, you know, because the only thing that Ian, the producer, would let him do was play cymbals. And the rest of it's like programmed, and it's terrible samples. And
wow.
It's just, so Danny, it's not like they were all like, oh, this is great, and what do you know, kid? It was more like, well, we're trusting this new thing, and we're going to try this, and maybe it'll result in some dollar signs and blah, blah, blah. You know, I just feel like, you know, I'm sure they aren't happy with that record either. It's not like I was the only one going, this is shit, guys. You know, yeah. Can I use the S word?
Yeah.
You can use anything you want, Jason.
Okay, sweet. Thanks. Good enough. So I think we were all in the same boat. I think they were just like, you know, hey, you might be right as far as being cool, but maybe we're through being cool. Mm-hmm. You know, so, which I can understand that as well. It is what it is. And that producer, man, you know, I really can't say enough about how he just did not listen to the band. He didn't respect the band's history at all. He just came in and kind of tore this whole thing apart and, you know,
wow.
Didn't really care about the, he wasn't sensitive to what the band was. You know, I think he probably saw it as this, he probably listened to the earlier records and was like, yeah, these are cute and charming, but this isn't going to sell anything. And, you know, we're like, yeah, but it's already doing all right. I mean, the band was known. I mean, I saw the band at the Palace a bunch of times, sold out, and the Palace was, I don't know, 1,000 people or something. So to me, that was like, man, you're huge, you know.
Yeah.
So,
agreed, yeah.
Like, we don't, this band isn't destined for the Forum. You know, it's not that kind of band. It was a band that was more of what we used to call, it was college rock. You know what I mean?
Yep.
That was the term before indie rock and alternative rock, all that stuff. Those terms, those labels didn't exist. It was literally called college rock. And so, right. You know, the guy, I think, just tried to make it a straight ahead pop band, and that's not what the band was. So.
Okay. Well, you know, I just want to close this 3 o'clock circle because we do want to talk about your solo work and work with other bands.
Yeah.
But I want to touch back on something you just mentioned, which was the Wild Honey concert that's a fundraiser for autism research. And this year's focus was the Kinks, the Village Green Preservation Society album. And you performed by yourself, Big Sky. And then with the 3 o'clock, you all did an amazing version of She's Got Everything. And we just wanted to touch upon, how did it feel playing with that lineup again? Well, you know, you said you hadn't played with Lewis, but, you know, you had Lewis, Danny, and Michael, and you. And
right.
How was that playing those two songs?
Right. Well, we only did that one song together, but I mean, Big Sky. So I first heard that record when I was probably early 20s. Somebody gave me a cassette that had the Village Green record, and then the other side was Odyssey and Oracle. And needless to say, that became my favorite cassette for like a decade. And I mean, I could not believe both of those albums. But, and in a way, the Kinks one, I mean, I love them both, obviously different bands and everything. But the Kinks one, I just really fell in love with Ray on that record. And, you know, so I wasn't sure if I was actually going to be able to do that show at all. But when I did have a little window in my insane schedule, I jumped at it. And, you know, Big Sky was, I was given like a handful of songs to choose from. And I was like, all right, that's the one.
Just to see, to that day.
all the time. Nice. Like compilation cassettes. So, yeah, that was great. And then, yeah, of course, I mean, getting up with Michael and Danny and Lewis. And, you know, Lewis was like, he was kind of a guitar inspiration to me when I was a kid, you know, because like I said, I was really into 3 o'clock when I was in high school. So he's one of that early group of rock guitar players that kind of impacted me. And I told him that, and he was pretty well chuffed, as they would say in the UK. But yeah, I love Lewis. And so that was the first time I've ever really even hung out with him. So, and it was just great to see Michael. And I see Danny a little bit more than the other guys, but I hadn't seen Danny for a long time. So yeah, that was super, super fun to do that with those guys. If you look at any of the footage, I'm just cracking up the whole time because I can't believe it's actually happening. You know?
Yeah, you and Lewis looked like you guys were having a blast.
Yeah.
Rocking out together.
Yeah, it was pretty fun.
So, Jason, after...
Just nerding out.
Yeah. And playing one of your favorite songs from your old mixtapes that used to end up on your mixtapes a lot, right? So, that's very cool.
Yeah.
Another great version that night. Yeah, Big Sky, fantastic. Oh,
so, following the 3 o'clock, you were recording some of your own stuff at home, and then you eventually joined with Roger Joseph Manning Jr., right, to start Jellyfish. And you, of course, worked on their first album, Belly Button. Can you tell us how you transitioned from the 3 o'clock to another band?
Well, so, yeah, when I was leaving, let's see. I keep forgetting how this went down, but this is actually how it went down. So that original Recycler ad that I had placed, where I looked a little further and saw the 3 o'clock ad, in my ad... it said, you know, singer songwriter, multi-instrumentalist looking for like-minded people and you know, into Bowie and XTC and the Blue Nile, I actually put, right?
Wow.
So, the thing that's very interesting to me about this and the reality that I only got one phone call on that ad.
What?
The thing that's interesting about that is people weren't really talking about David Bowie yet. Because it's sort of like he hadn't gone away yet. And, mm-hmm. you know, when I say gone away, you know, he kind of recessed a little bit after the kind of the Glass Spider era. And then there was the Tin Machine, all that stuff. And it was kind of like, I think that's when the general public started looking back at, you know, the miracle of his first 15 years. And so, yeah, what's interesting about that is I only got one call on an ad that said David Bowie, and no other ads. Nobody was talking about David Bowie. It was, you know, it was a lot of hair metal, and it was a lot of, you know, some punk, but really nobody talking about David Bowie or XTC or anything like that. So the one phone call I got was from Roger.
Oh, wow.
And so that's when I met Roger. He came out, he was at USC or something, and he came out and we to my parents' house where I lived, and we play each other some songs on the grand piano. And, you know, I just thought like, it's interesting to know somebody else, you know, briefly who is into this stuff, but I didn't think I was going to be in a band with that guy. And, we said our goodbyes and then the whole thing of me getting in the 3 o'clock happened. Yeah. So then the 3 o'clock was touring. We were playing in San Jose. And the opening band, some guy comes up to me after their sound check. I think we were about to sound check. Or maybe we had just finished sound checking or whatever. And this guy comes up to me and he goes, hey, you're Jason Faulkner. I'm like, yeah. And he goes, I think our keyboard player knows you. I'm like, who's your keyboard player? And he's like, Roger Manning. I'm like, what?
Oh, wow.
Roger Manning. And so this little guy comes over to me. He's like, yeah, man. And I'm like, no way, dude. And he's like, yeah, yeah. Because... God, I'm trying to remember the sequence of events, but at some point he had called me saying, you know, I moved up to San Francisco again, and we've been racking our brains for a guitar player, and you're the guy. And I was like, well, I just joined at 3 o'clock. And he was like, what? And so we were like laughing about that. And then this is probably like a year after that where, you know, I'm running to him again at this club.
Okay.
And he's like, well, the singer in this band is the guy where the two of us want you to be the guitar player. Like, so check us out and see what you think.
Oh, wow.
And so I watched their show and I was floored by Andy. And so that kind of planted the seed of not only my departure from the 3 o'clock, which I was already planning on doing anyway. That tour was brutal. So that's when I decided to kind of start. The three of us kind of started talking about forming what became Jellyfish.
Wow.
But again, it was a big thank you to the recycler.
Who knew the recycler?
Exactly. The recycler is the Cuban of rock, apparently.
I think that's fantastic.
I want to bring out Mr. Jason Faulkner. Yeah.
Arigato.
Jason agreed to come over and play a song that a lot of you might remember. So I want to hear this tent explode. You better sing along, please.
That is why I give.
Faulkner, ladies and
Thank
gentlemen.
Thank you, Roger.
You're so welcome. We're going to do it again. Fuji Rock 2010. We'll be back with that.
Okay, so one of the things that we've read was that you had stated previously, a while ago, you'd stated that you had no plans to join another band after Jellyfish, but somehow end up in the Grays. And the Grays released one album on Epic, Rochambeau. And on a side note, in our conversation with Matt Pucci from Rain Parade, we learned that being in a band with multiple songwriters can just be tricky. And so our question to you is, did you find it difficult being in a band, you know, another band, the Grays, with several songwriters?
Yeah, I mean, the whole concept of the Grays, we had this really, really innocent, cute, but like just brutally flawed concept, which was that we were going to all, like we all were really, we'd all had bad experiences in bands and, you know, trying to make personalities work and all that stuff. And so we had this idea that somehow we've figured out that we've cracked the code. And what we're going to do is we're going to, this is a band of four generals, no soldiers, which is already, it's never going to happen. And and then not only that, but whenever it's, say, Buddy song, then the other three, the other remaining three of us, the other three generals, heavily decorated, are going to be the best sidemen possible for said songwriter at the moment. And, you know, that would work for all three of us. And it just, you know, like it was a cute idea. And we talked about it over many drinks at many different bars and seemed like we were going to be able to make this work. And then, you know, of course, as soon as we started making the record and I brought in Jack Quigg, who had done the Jellyfish stuff, and Jack preferred my songs and my voice to the other guys. So Jack was always pushing for me to have more songs on the record. That's why it's slightly unbalanced where I have four songs and the other two guys have three. Well, you can imagine what that did to our little concept, where all of a sudden it seems that there's a real leader emerging.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's, I mean, just that little detail of having one extra song kind of threw our whole thing into a tailspin.
Okay, it started a long time ago when I was a little boy. Sometimes a little one don't do what he's told, and mother puts back his toy. Yes, there is something you can do.
I had so much fun making that record, and I was just kind of on fire. Like, I was really just bursting at the seams with ideas and exuberance. And, you know, I did a lot to everybody else's songs as well. I did a ton of work on Buddy's stuff and even John's stuff. And I, unfortunately, just never really got along. Like, once we started making the record and all this stuff, and we'd been kind of fast friends before that. But, yeah, that just kind of tore it apart. So I've always said that band was kind of doomed from its inception just because of our wacky ideas. And, you know, it just, yes, it was too, you need to have people that are leading it, and you need to have some people who are following it. And ideally you have a band situation to have, you know, everybody kind of develop, carves out their little place in the band. And, you know, maybe one person is really good at the business and dealing with the manager. And maybe one person is really good at the handling all the kind of artwork and all that stuff. And then, you know, it's great when it can be delegated and everybody knows their place and then they're happy in their place. That's the challenging part, is finding people who accept that maybe they're not the leader of the band,
right,
but you know what? They're the best guy. They're the best guy doing this. Right. And the leader of the band can't do that because he doesn't have the mental energy to do that after he's writing all these songs, you know? That band, everybody wanted to do everything. So it was just like kind of torturous, actually.
So speaking of the artwork, I believe your father did the artwork. Is that correct for this album?
Well, he did all these big paintings, and then the label screwed that up by making this absurd circular collage out of our faces that none of us liked the way that looked. But it was like one of those things where it was done and we couldn't really comment about it. And it's like, okay, well, I guess that's, I just thought it should have been the four paintings, mm-hmm. just, you know, two on top, two on bottom. And that's it. Just a little more classic. But again, you know, that artwork to me is kind of a similar situation as the production of the 3 o'clock record, where it was just like this kind of,
yeah,
you know, this kind of like this kind of style that was happening. That but yeah, my dad is a painter and he did all these really cool paintings, and there's paintings inside as well, and even the CD itself is a painting that my dad did of us.
That's cool. That's really cool. Well,
yeah, he's a great painter.
Your songs on Rochambeau are really, really good. And this album that was released on Epic is out of print now. Do you know of any plans to reissue this? I've actually reached out to a couple labels and suggested it, including Omnivore, and they're like, oh, we're all about that album. We just can't get the licensing. Do you know anything about a possible reissue?
I don't know anything about the reissue of that record. You know, I think it'd be a good idea to reissue it. I think it'd be great to have that on vinyl as well.
Agreed, yes.
But, you know, but I just don't know. And it wouldn't be at the top of my priorities as far as reissue stuff. I'm kind of more excited about reissuing my first two solo records. But yeah, I mean, I would love it if somebody would put that out again. And, you know, maybe I could be involved and actually make a penny.
That would be nice. It sounds like there's definitely interest in that. So I think that the trick is the licensing. But speaking of your first two records, enough of this band stuff. I really love your solo album. So in 1996, you released Presents Author Unknown, a fabulous album. And this is where it gets really exciting for me because I love your solo album. So on Author Unknown, you play almost everything, right?
Yeah, I'm playing everything except I had my friend Alan Johannes, who's a tremendous talent. I had him come down and he plays what I call the bumblebee guitar on Miracle Medicine. And that, I believe, is the only guest.
Wow.
And it's just that little frenetic guitar at the end. It's just kind of like, like kind of buzzing around the chords. And that's why I called it a bumblebee. If I was ever to confuse things, I would most certainly abuse. Now that you all can read my mind, I think it's safe to say you might. You would then subsequently But yeah, no, that's me playing everything. My whole thing, I was always doing, I mean, ever since I was a teenager, I remember when I first realized that I could take two cassette decks and I could like record something like on the left, you know, just a mono thing on the left or right side. And then I could play that back, feed that into another cassette deck, and then record something while that's being printed onto the second cassette deck. I could record something live with that. Nice. And then keep doing that and bouncing back and forth. And I could kind of multi-track with two crappy, you know, TIAC cassette decks. And that was just a revelation. And I made all these recordings like that when I was a teenager. And then when I was a little bit later teen, maybe 17 or 18, I permanently borrowed, which means I stole a cassette deck. I stole my friend's Tascam Porta 1.
Oh, wow.
Which was a which was a crazy revelation for me. It was like, oh my God, this is a 4-track cassette. So now, and you know, it's like, okay, and I never had a manual because he didn't have the manual. So I just learned how to use this thing in my own way and in my own time. And I used to get maybe 16 tracks on that thing. Because you just keep recording a new thing and balancing the old things together with it over and over and over again until you can seriously multi-track on that thing. And that's where, like, I did a record on, what was that label? Spin Art.
Oh,
called
right.
Necessity, the 4-track years. And those are, most of those songs are those 4 tracks that I did on that Tascam.
That was released in 2001. That was pretty cool to hear that. So you were kind of using the same technology that the Beatles did on Sgt. Pepper's almost.
I it was just a cassette instead of a big piece of tape.
Yeah.
It was just a little tiny piece of tape. But yeah, same concept. And the cool thing about that is that it forces you to commit and, you know, forces you to have strong ideas. And like I said, commit to those ideas because you can't tinker with it. And, so, you know, I feel like growing up with something like that is like valuable, you know, because again, you just have to know, you figure out what you're doing and you got to mean it. You know, you can't like open it up and, you know, can't keep tinkering with it in Pro Tools, you know, like everybody does. I was always playing drums first. I would record the drums, just singing the song along in my, singing the song in my head.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So oftentimes not even a click. I just start going for it with the drums, and then I just build the song up from that foundation. But that, you know, I went straight from a 4-track to Chick Corea's studio here in Silver Lake.
Wow.
Which had a, you know, needless to say, a 2-inch 24-track machine and a Neve 8078 console.
Oh.
So I went from a Tascam Porta 1 to that with nothing in between. And
that's a jump right there.
It's a serious jump. Yeah, yeah. And but I just recorded that first record just like I did my 4-tracks, you know, just drums first and just build everything on top of it until I think it's done. Oftentimes I do a lot of reduction at the end because I'm like, okay, I threw every idea I had onto this thing and now it's just a little bit of a mess. So take some things out and, you know, there it is.
Wow.
But yeah, that record was definitely one of the high points of my life thus far. I had been in these two band situations that were less than ideal.
Even three, you know, three bands, right?
Three bands. Yeah, yeah. I forgot about that. Three less than ideal situations. And then all of a sudden, I was signed as a solo artist, which is what I always wanted to be doing anyway. And I was left alone, man. I didn't have nobody said a peep to me about what I should do on that record. I don't have any stories of, oh man, I made a mistake listening to the label and I really didn't do what I meant. I don't have a single story like that. I think I learned that lesson so profoundly in the 3 o'clock. You know, like, just don't listen to these people, man. They don't know. They don't even know what they're talking about. They don't respect this band. You know, they don't respect us as people. It's just, you know, it's a different motivation or whatever. So for me, it was like, you know, I almost had like kind of an arrogance about like, nobody's going to tell me what to do. And I just went bananas at that studio. I was there for like 2 months.
Wow.
And it was a thrill, man. It was a super high point in my life. One of them. And
no cheesy gimmicks, like no jellyfish gimmicky kind of stuff. I love jellyfish, but it's pretty gimmicky. So you have none
gimmicky.
Of that.
Yeah, I had a problem with that gimmick. That's one of the things I could never, it just never sat well with me. The you know, I didn't think the band needed that. No. I didn't care at all about that. And for me, you know, something that is important, that's kind of a thread in all of my stuff is, yeah, it's serious. And hopefully people can hear that I'm very sincere and that I'm, mm-hmm. you know, writing from the heart and all that stuff. But there's also like a lot of humor and there's a lot of like things that kind of pull and tug at the sincerity of something. And I really like that. If something is too much one way or just kind of too two dimensional, I get really bored. And so I like to, you know, kind of make things a little bit more obscure. And that was in full effect on that first record. You know, there's even the sound of it. Like I wasn't trying to make an engineering award sounding record. And I was trying mm-hmm. to make something that I later called mid-fi. You know, it's not lo-fi and it's not hi-fi. It's kind of somewhere, you know, it's kind of like this mid-fi thing. And
yeah. And
that was, I'm so into that because I'm into all these different kinds of bands. I mean, I love Steely Dan and Asia, but I also love Guided by Voices. And, you know, so like, if sonically I'm going to be operating on both of those.
Nice.
You know, from coming from both of those places, like at any given time, and maybe within the same song, there'll be some really like crappy sounding thing that's just kind of like struggling to come through the speakers. And then there'll be something that's super clean at the same time. And I just love that. I love that kind of like, you know, juxtaposition.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Now that you mentioned it, that's something that you're really good at because the recordings are clean, but they always have an edge to it that doesn't make mm-hmm. it so polished that it's like squeaky clean. And I love that about
right.
it, but I've never thought about that, but that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
And Jason, just to follow up on that, you know, cause I think when fans of your music take listens to your solo records, you know, and I'm talking between the years 1996 through 2009, we definitely hear that. We definitely hear that that genuineness in
right.
in the songs, and we hear this kind of very earnest music and artistry. But one of the right. things that I found really interesting about what you just said is, you know, no one said a peep to me. I did that record, and I guided it. So we're yeah. really curious. Between that period of time, 96 to 09, you release all these solo records and the last couple of them on a Japanese label, Noise McCartney Records. What inspired you to release those last couple of records there?
You mean where like, it's really
through
hard
that
for
label.
Everybody else to get?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the quick answer to that is that the label in Japan was the only label that was banging down my door and offering me a bag of money. You know, that like, I guess after, Can You Still Feel, my second record,
I was in a bar.
got a little bit disenchanted with the whole process, and I got a little bit, you know, sort of couldn't really find the reason why to do all this stuff. I mean, I'm making this music for myself and because I feel like I have to make music and I have to write songs and I love recording all this stuff. And none of that, like no business foul can mess with that. Mm-hmm. But I guess, yeah, I just got a little disenchanted with the whole
the business part of it,
like making a record and then like putting it out and then seeing it just flounder, because while everybody's like, this is like the best thing I've ever heard, and then that's it. And then it's like, so, you know, just it felt kind of, you know, it's painful. It's heartbreaking. And I'm not saying like I thought that I deserved to be, you know, superstar or anything like that, but I definitely wanted to be able to tour and take a band out on the road and do it right. And then build this thing up and like get to a place where I'm playing theaters and all that stuff and having a light show and having, you know, being able to put on a show instead of just constantly playing little clubs and smelling the guy's breath from the band before and on the mic. And, you know, it's just like, it wasn't like escalating. And so I kind of ducked out for a while. And then, yeah, like in the mid-2000s, this label was like, hey, we want to put out your records. You know, you have a big fan base over here. They were giving me like a very real amount of money for a little tiny label.
Wow.
And they were like, hey, can you give us, you know, the record by this time? And I actually work really well with deadlines.
Uh-huh.
Even though it would seem like I don't, because I put out my last records like 9 years ago. So it doesn't really seem like that's true at all. But in reality, if somebody is like I loved the whole thing of, hey, can you give me a second?
Sure.
Sorry.
No problem. No,
are we, is this like live right now?
No. No, we'll edit it.
Oh, it's not. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, I'll be right back.
Not a problem.
Thanks. And that's the end of part one. On our next episode, part two of our conversation with Jason Faulkner.
Bed, but it's always alone with a handful of friends. Trouble at home. She wants to be good. She knows that she should, but with the knowledge of this, there's no way she could. See the way this could be.
gone.